How do you react when famine finds you in the land of promise? How do you react when you feel like you're in the center of God's will? You've been faithfully following, doing everything you can to be obedient to God, and you face hardship. What happens when your obedient world is a world of turmoil? When the days of doing the will of God are fraught with problems and sorrows? How do you react to that? How do you respond? Oftentimes, I believe that we have bought into the myth that if we're doing what God wants us to do, if we're doing His will, if we're trying to be obedient, then life ought to go well. It ought to work out. There's only one problem with that. If we served the kind of God who gave us good things all the time as a response to our faithfulness, what kind of a God would we be serving? Wouldn't He be the God who was buying our obedience? I mean, it'd be a great deal, wouldn't it? Everybody would be a Christian. If being a Christian meant life would be perfect from now on, it'd be a great, great investment. See, God's not in the business of buying our obedience. God doesn't promise that things will always go well because we're doing the right thing. In fact, Jesus said exactly the opposite in John chapter 16, verse 33. He said, "In this world you will have trouble." And you know what that means, don't you? You've experienced your fair share of trouble. None of us are strangers to pain. Pain's part of the life we live. And even in the midst of doing God's will, oftentimes we face problems. Last night I got the telephone call that I expected to get 6 weeks and 2 days ago. You see, 6 weeks and 2 days ago I got the call that my grandfather had passed away, and he was not the one I was expecting to die. It was my grandmother who died last night. So tomorrow again I board the plane to fly to Michigan to preach the funeral of a grandparent that was very close to me. And I'm not alone in this. You know what that's like. You've been there before. When things that life throws at you are tough, and they're difficult, when your dreams don't come together, and even in the midst of doing good things, you find difficulty and problems. How do you respond to that? How do you deal with those kind of problems? Well, there's a way to deal with it, to deal with it in faith, or there's another way to deal with it, and we're going to look at that other way this morning as we look at our hero that has feet of clay. There's a second question that I want to ask and answer through this time this morning, and it's related, but it is somewhat different, and that is, can God use a person who's had problems? Can a person who's failed in his faith ever be restored? Now, in this series on the life of Abram, we're looking at a man who is going to be characterized above all people in the Bible as being a man of faith. This guy leads the ideal life of faith, or at least when it's all said and done, he's called the friend of God because of his faith. We know that without faith, according to the writer of Hebrews, it's impossible to please God. And Abraham made God very happy with his life of faith. But we're also going to discover that at key points along the way, he had major failures. And this is one of them. Recall a couple weeks ago when God spoke from heaven and said, "Hey, go to the land that you've never seen before." And he packed up and did that. He was on the pinnacle of faith. The guy did it. He landed in the land of Canaan. God says, "This is where I called you to be," and he gets there, and guess what? Life is not all it is cracked up to be in the land of promise. In fact, it's a problem. And then he's forced to deal with that problem, and we see here his first major failure of faith. And it won't be the last. Let's read the passage together. Genesis chapter 12, verses 10 through 20. Genesis 12, verse 10 says, "Now there was a famine in the land, and Abram went down to Egypt to live there for a while because the famine was severe. As he was about to enter Egypt, he said to his wife, 'Sarai, I know what a beautiful woman you are. When the Egyptians see you, they will say, "This is his wife." Then they will kill me, but will let you live. Say you are my sister so that I shall be treated well for your sake, and my life will be spared because of you.' When Abram came to Egypt, the Egyptians saw that she was a very beautiful woman. And when Pharaoh's officials saw her, they praised her to Pharaoh, and she was taken into his palace. And he treated Abram well for her sake, and Abram acquired sheep and cattle and male and female donkeys, men servants and maidservants and camels. But the Lord inflicted serious diseases on Pharaoh and his household because of Abram's wife Sarai. So Pharaoh summoned Abram. "What have you done to me?" he said. "Why didn't you tell me she was your wife? Why did you say she's my sister so that I took her to be my wife? Now then, here is your wife. Take her and go." Then Pharaoh gave orders about Abram to his men, and they sent him on his way and with his wife and everything he had. Say, well, that's a pretty incredible story. It really is. There's a lot here that we're going to look at this morning, but you know, the basic issue here is here's a guy who is willing to deliver up his wife to save his own neck. And I know that at least 51% of this audience from this day forward is going to have a major problem with Abram. It's not quite as bad as you think it is, but it's bad. And what we see here is that this guy resorts to deception for protection. When his faith fails and he doesn't know what to do, he resorts to deception for protection. And you know what? I believe that a lot of us do that. A lot. Let's look at these principles together in this passage. First of all, we see that when faith fails, we often resort to deception. When faith fails, we often resort to deception. You see, he's in the land of promise, and there's a famine in the land of promise. Can you believe that? There should never be a famine in the land of promise. The land of promise is a land that flows with milk and honey, and the skies are always blue, and everything works out, isn't it? Wrong. He's in the land of promise, and he faces a famine, and this is an ongoing famine. Notice in verse 10, there was a famine in the land. The verb tense there indicates this is an ongoing deal. Not only that, but the latter part of the verse says that the famine was severe. This was a bad one. This is not a mild test. People starved to death in famines. So lest you think that this is a little test, you're wrong. Getting laid off is less severe than facing a famine, as bad as that may sound. The guy's in a severe test, and so he goes to Egypt. Now, the thing we note here in the text is he doesn't consult with God. He just does what he thinks is the smart thing to do. And, you know, from his standpoint, it makes complete sense. It would make sense to me. He came to the land of Canaan. He got there in the northern part of the land as he moved across the Fertile Crescent and started to come down. And there he stopped at Shechem, which was a major city. And you know what he discovered at Shechem? The land that God had promised to him was already deeded to another people. The real estate that God said, "This is going to be your land," there were people living there. God hadn't cleared the deal with the Canaanites before he promised it to Abram. So here he shows up, and it's a great worship experience. He builds an altar, God appears, he preaches the gospel, but there's no room. So he keeps traveling south, and he gets to Bethel and has the same experience. He builds an altar, and it's a great place, but guess what? Their people are living there. And so he journeys further south to the Negev, which, if you know the topography of the area, is a very desolate, arid place. And when he lands there, there's no people around. There's plenty of room. There's also no water. And there's no place to live. And then the famine sets in, and 6 days' journey is Egypt. And Egypt's the place where the Nile River runs constantly, and the crops grow, and there's food there. And so he decides to leave the land of promise to go to the land of Egypt. That makes perfect sense, doesn't it? Any good businessman would put two and two together and decide that, you know, the profit's to be made over here and there's nothing cooking here, and hey, let's get up and go, guys. It's not going to work out. In the process of that, he leaves the place that God has placed him to go to greener pastures. And that begins the process of compounding his problem. You see, as he moves forward, there are other dangers ahead, worse dangers in store. In fact, in verse 11, as he was about to enter Egypt, he said to his wife, "Sarah, I know what a beautiful woman you are." Suddenly, he realizes that there's something more in jeopardy than dying of starvation. I mean, he's got a great-looking wife, and this is going to be a problem. In fact, he goes on to say that the Egyptians seem to have a code of ethics where they won't commit adultery, but they are willing to murder. They will kill him in order to get his wife. And that's what he's afraid of. They're going to kill me in order to get you. We've got to come up with a plan. Now, a lot of people have questioned why Sarah would be considered so beautiful. After all, she is about 65 years old here. In fact, she probably is closer to 67 or 68 because when they left Ur, she was 65. And so some time has elapsed here. And she's 10 years younger than Abram. He's 75. And so she's about 65. And he recognizes her beauty. And so does Pharaoh. And all the people in the land of Egypt recognize the beauty. And so in order to give you a couple explanations about why that might be the case, at the risk of getting in serious trouble, in fact, I proposed some of these explanations to the elders on Friday morning. And they said, hey, don't say that. But this is an enlightened audience. Very mature. And I would want you to know what they told me not to say. Not because I would actually ever say that. But just so you would know what they do not want me to say to you, okay? See, one of the possible explanations that came up in some remote commentary someplace, probably some ancient Jewish scroll someplace, was that Sarah had not had any children. And maybe that could be the reason why she maintained her beauty. Now, they suggested that I not say that. And I think that they were probably pretty wise. Maybe that's why they're the elders. So I didn't say that, okay? Some of the more plausible explanations are that people are living a considerably longer period of time then than they are now. In fact, Abram's father, Terah, lived to be 205 years old. And based on the history that we've looked at with the what happened with the world at creation and then the flood and the changes that took place there, it's probably the significant amount of ultraviolet radiation that causes the aging process that we know today was not as intense as it was. And that's why people were living longer. So maybe she was more like 45 in her chronological years as opposed to 65. And of course, we all know that women reach their peak of physical beauty at 45, right? Or 55, or for some of you, maybe 65. Actually, whatever age you are today. And tomorrow. That's the perfect age, right? In addition to that, cultures view beauty differently. For those of you who have ever stopped to look at Renaissance paintings, you will know that the Renaissance didn't worship women who were young and thin. They worshiped women who were more matronly, more fully endowed. That was the picture of beauty. Was a woman of that nature. And so today in our culture, we worship an image that's much more youthful and much more slim and much more muscular. But cultures of all times haven't looked at beauty in the same way that we do. You never saw any anorexic woman in a Renaissance painting, have you? And it's probably that they had a different concept of beauty back then, which would have included someone that was more mature in their looks. Whatever the case, there was beauty in this woman, and not only was she beautiful, but Abram recognized that, and Pharaoh and the people there. Guys, one thing I would say to you is that of all the bad things Abram does in this passage, the one thing he doesn't do is he doesn't fail to recognize the beauty in his wife. He looks at her and sees her as beautiful. And I just wonder how many times you do that. How many times I do that. How many times do you look at the woman God gave you and look into her eyes and see her beauty? And maybe even tell her that she's beautiful. Maybe even tell her that. Boy, he said, I've got a good thing here. In fact, she's so good that I'm in trouble. And that's where the deception set in. And Abram comes up with a great idea. Notice what he does. He says, when the Egyptians see you, they will say, this is his wife. Then they will kill me, but you will live. Say you are my sister, that I will be treated well for your sake, and my life will be spared because of you. Now, at first that sounds like a bad idea, but it's really not a bad idea. because the privileged right of brothers over their sisters would have put him in a position of power. If they went into the land and he told everybody that she is my sister, then if they wanted to court her, they would be required to come through him. And he could put them off. Remember what Laban did, putting the marriage with Rachel and Leah off 7 years? He could put them off. He could make the dowry so high that they couldn't pay it. There were a number of things that he could do that he could propose to them in such a way that he could kind of keep this thing under control. And for as long as the famine was, if he could just kind of keep putting people off, then eventually they could go back to the land and she could come out of hiding and she would be perceived, they'd make it through. And we're going to find a fatal flaw in his thinking there. But he's got this plan figured out that, you know, I can both save my neck and keep my wife out of trouble. And he begins to resort to deception. Now, it is true to some degree that she is his sister. In fact, in chapter 20, we're going to find out that she is actually his half-sister. Sarah is actually Abram's half-sister. And so there is an element of truth to what he's saying. Isn't that convenient? You know, that's how deception works. As long as we can get enough truth in there that we're not completely being deceptive, then that's enough most of the time. How many times when you're backed into a corner do you find a way to bend the truth or change the truth to fit your situation in such a way that it comes out to your benefit? How many times do you find yourself maybe not saying the whole truth, or maybe just giving partial truth, or maybe answering a question in a way that it would appear that you're giving an answer, but you're really not giving the answer that's intended, in order to deceive the person that you're dealing with? You know what that marks? That marks a failure in faith. That's saying, well, I don't believe that God can protect me in this situation. God can't carry me through. I'm in a jam, and I've got to resort to my own ingenuity and cleverness in order to fix my problem, in order to resolve the issue at hand. You see, we oftentimes take the insider information that we have, that is that slice of truth, and use that insider information to come up with a story or to come up with something that benefits us. You know, when that happens in the public eye, we tend to scoff at it. I remember a few years back when Ivan Boesky and some of the guys on Wall Street were accused of using insider information to their advantage and thus deceiving the investors in order to make grand sums of money. During that time, an article appeared in the USA Today by columnist J. Taylor Buckley Jr., and here's what he said. He asks some poignant questions. He says, "Why all this fuss over a little insider dealing on Wall Street, for heaven's sake? Come on now, tell me you've never done it. Wasn't that you, age 7, who went to PS 47, that's Public School 47, for those of you who didn't live in the big city, with a mom-made liver sandwich and palmed it off as a genuine PB&J in a brilliant swap for 1.5 Twinkies? You knew what was in the sandwich. And you remember the time you sold that wreck of a Buick, and only you knew that the transmission case was held together with crazy glue. You should have done hard time for that. Remember the waiter at that spiffy restaurant who alerted you privately that the raisins in the ham sauce were not really raisins at all? He might not have made $100 million off of it, but you did tip him at least 12%, and you saved a pile on kaopectate. And of course, you turned yourself in and didn't profit from the insider information when you found a copy of the history exam stuck in the Xerox machine. Did you tell the world when you found that busted parking meter that always showed 22 minutes left and the payphone that gave more than it received? And remember the time you were snorkeling around in the light bulb display at the supermarket and found a whole bunch marked 39 cents way in the back behind the ones marked 89 cents? Yes, from three aisles over, we heard your booming voice. Oh, clerk, I think the rest of the shoppers should be informed about these light bulbs and share in these substantial savings. Sure, we heard you. Like we heard you the time that the PCP fogged fast food genius stuffed 3 chicken breasts in the bag after you'd paid for only a couple of dark meats. We heard you, equipped with the inside information, you demanded loud and clear, oh manager, it's only right for all the customers to get the special bonus. Seriously now, tell us you've never used insider information to your advantage. After all, using inside stuff for personal gain is as American as a fuzzbuster. isn't it? Backed into a corner. Situation looks tough. And there are all kinds of things that are partially true that we can use to get ourselves out of a jam. With people like the IRS. With people like our spouses and our kids. Remember when you tell the employer that the project's really almost done, when it probably will be done by 2 o'clock in the afternoon if there are no more phone calls and he hires 5 people to help you during the day. Almost is a relative term. I can't really trust you, God, to get me out of this tough situation or to help me through it, and so therefore I will resort to deception. I will use a little bit of truth and a lot of lie to get me through it. Well, Abram does that, and it appears to work, except for a few problems. We see that sometimes when faith fails and life works, we become the person who's deceived. And I think that's what happens to Abram. First, he is a deceiver, and then he buys into his own lie, and he becomes deceived. Look at what happens in verse 14. When Abram came to Egypt, the Egyptians saw that she was a very beautiful woman. And when Pharaoh's officials saw her, they praised her to Pharaoh, and she was taken into his palace. You see, there's only one problem with his plan. You don't put Pharaoh off. Any other suitor in the land of Egypt, Abram could have put him off, except for Pharaoh. If it would have been any other person that would have pursued her, he would have gotten out of it, but he couldn't get out of it with Pharaoh. So you don't tell the king of the land you can't do what you want to do. And when Pharaoh found out she was free and available, he immediately snatched her up and brought her into the harem. This guy is in the process of losing his wife. He's tried a deceptive trick play, thinking that he's smart enough to figure out a way to make this work. And what ends up happening is he's in the process of losing his wife. Does he go into convulsions over it? I don't see that happening in the passage. And the reason why I don't see that happening in the passage is because he becomes deceived. Look what happens in the next verse. And he, that is Pharaoh, treated Abram well for her sake. What did Abram want? All I want to do is be treated well. Say you are my sister, and so I will be treated well. It will go well for me. That's what the text says in verse 13. He wanted to be treated well. Well, he is being treated well by Pharaoh. And Abram acquired sheep and cattle and male and female donkeys and men servants and maid servants and camels. Man, the guy's getting rich. This is a very lucrative situation. Pharaoh, in an attempt to show his gratitude for this man bringing his sister to his land, starts dumping all kinds of goodies on him. All kinds of stuff. And the text is silent when it comes to Abram trying to do anything to save his wife. We don't see him trying. There's nothing that's said at all about his attempt to try to save the situation. Now, I've tried to speculate on what Abram might have been thinking, and I'm not sure. The writer doesn't give us enough information to read his mind, but just from a human standpoint, trying to think through what might be going on here is he may be saying, well, you know, it's Pharaoh. There's nothing I can do about it. You know, if I try to get her out, if I go tell him I lied now, then I'll get killed. I don't want to try that. So there's nothing I can do about it. And besides that, man, think about the profit that's rolling in here. You know, Sarah would understand because with all this wealth coming in, sooner or later I'm going to be able to find a way to sneak her out of there. And you know, I know it's a bad situation for her, but, you know, if she can just survive for a little while, look at all the benefits that are coming in. I don't know what his thinking is. But somehow in this process, he starts enjoying the fact that he's got the stuff coming in. And his attempt to get his wife out is not here in the text. I don't see it at all, him attempting to try to get her out of there. Now, there's a significant problem from the standpoint of God here. Not only has this guy put his wife in jeopardy, but also the promise is in jeopardy. God promised Abram that he would be the father of a great nation. And here is his wife in the harem with another man. Now, if Pharaoh sleeps with her, that whole promise is violated because the purity of that line would be gone. Nobody would ever be able to prove that the child was not Pharaoh's child, and so the promise goes down the drain. You see, the very promise is now in jeopardy because of this man's failure in faith and his deceptive lying. What's he do? Doesn't appear to do anything. You know, oftentimes, what we perceive as blessings are really curses. things that we think of that could be the best possible thing are not good for us at all. And sometimes we chalk up to God blessings when God's not giving us those blessings at all. In fact, they may be coming from the world. All this wealth that's coming in, what's it going to benefit Abram? How's he going to benefit from that? Well, we're going to see in chapter 13 that when Abram finally gets out of there with all this stuff, that he goes back to the land of Canaan and finds out that there's not enough room on the grazing pastures of Canaan for all of his cattle and all of his nephew's cattle. So what happens? Abram and Lot, his nephew, have to split up and go in separate directions because they can't live together with all these cattle. He's getting all this prosperity in, and that prosperity is going to cause his family to divide. A blessing? Maybe not. Not only that, but one of the things that he acquires, verse 16, is maidservants. That would be a female slave. Now, who will become Sarah's rival in a few chapters? The woman's name is Hagar. And who is Hagar? She is an Egyptian slave woman. It's very probable that the woman who will come into their life to cause a significant problem later on down the road was acquired here when he was getting all this prosperity. A blessing? Maybe not. Maybe a curse. Now we see the deceiver becoming deceived. Somehow in this process, this is working out for him. Somehow in this warped sense of looking at reality, this is working out for him. Does that mean he doesn't sorrow over Sarah's situation? No, I think he's shedding great tears over that, but he's unable, immobilized to do anything about it. And he doesn't do anything to help her. Well, our hope is that when we become faithless, God steps in and he remains faithful. Look what God does in verse 17. Verse 17, "But the Lord inflicted serious diseases on Pharaoh and his household because of Abram's wife Sarah." The serious diseases here, we're not sure exactly how he equated that the diseases came from this woman being in his household. We're not sure, the text doesn't tell us, but a Pharaoh of that magnitude, the ruler of Egypt, probably when things didn't go well would assume that some god was upset with him and probably began to have all of his religious people, all of his guys that worship these different gods, begin to probe and ask questions to try to figure out what it was that was causing the problem. And sooner or later, the truth came out. Sarai's married to another guy. Now, fortunately, he hasn't married her yet, and we see that from the line of questioning that he asked Abram. He hasn't married her yet, but God steps in immediately to protect this guy, Abram, and to protect his wife, Sarai, by inflicting diseases. This is a supernatural intervention. And look what Pharaoh says. Verse 18, "So Pharaoh summoned Abram. 'What have you done to me?' he said. 'Why didn't you tell me she was your wife? Why did you say she is my sister so that I took her to be my wife? Now then, here is your wife. Take her and go.' The Pharaoh gave orders about Abram to his men, and they sent him on his way with his wife and everything he had." Well, he packed him up and got him out of there. You know, here's a situation where Pharaoh doesn't have a whole lot of respect for God's man, but he has a whole lot of respect for God. A whole lot of respect for God. I think one of the key tests of failure in the Christian life is when pagan people begin to rebuke us. Here's a situation where Pharaoh says, "You call yourself a man of God and you do this? That's incredible." Does God ever speak through non-Christians to us? I believe he does. And when you start hearing those people around you saying to you, "You mean to tell me that you call yourself a Christian and you behave like that?" That's a real significant warning. What have I done? Where am I headed? And here, this man respects God more than Abram does. He calls Abram on the carpet for what he's done. One of the hopeful things in this passage is God's faithful. God had promised that he would protect Abram. He promised that he would bring the seed through Abram. He promised that he would make him a great nation. And God steps in and protects him, even in the midst of this failure. Abram does the wrong thing, and God steps in and fixes it. God steps in and saves him in the midst of that. Is there hardship for Abram because of this? I think there absolutely is. There are consequences that are going to trail him for a long time. But God still steps in and saves the day. Because that's the character of God. God says that when you are faithless, I remain faithful. God, in the midst of his judgment, says that my mercies are new every morning. My faithfulness to you is great. I don't give up on you. I don't just let you go. I don't just turn you out to pasture because of your sin. I respond to you and I'll come back to you in faithfulness. And that's the kind of God we serve. We resort to deception. We go to trick plays. When things aren't going our way, we try to figure out a way to fix it on our own, to come up with a half-truth that will use our intelligence to try to make it work out. That's not what God does. God comes in his faithfulness and deals with us in righteousness. The first question I ask this morning is, what happens to you when you have famine in the promised land? What do you do? You see, deception for the purpose of protection is a failure in faith. And when we resort to trick plays of our own human ingenuity, we've failed in faith. We're not doing what God's called us to do. The second question, though, that I want to address for just a moment as we close is the issue of, can God ever use people that have failed? You know, here's Abram. He's the father of the faithful. And he does something really bad here. This is bad. Can he ever be restored? The truth is that he will be. And he'll go on to do great things for God. He'll go on to do great things for God. That doesn't mean he's not going to face hardship. That doesn't mean he doesn't have something to pay here, which he does. But he's going to be used by God in the future. I think there are many people that walk around in life who've blown it. And as much as you can see of your life is that one moment, that snapshot in time, when you made the wrong decision and you sinned and you blatantly disobeyed God and you rebelled against him, and you look back to that, and that's all you see when you look at your life. If you could paint a portrait of your life on the wall, that one moment is the defining moment for all of your life. Now, I'm not saying that that moment may not affect the rest of your life, because it very well may. But the life of faith is defined on the long picture when you look at life over the history of your life. And there are many people here that are immobilized in their ability to move forward in their relationship with God because you're looking back to a time when you failed and you say, it's over for me. I'm all done. Chuck Colson responds to that in his book, Loving God, when he says these words. He says, the real legacy of my life was my biggest failure, that I am an ex-convict. My greatest humiliation, being sent to prison, was the beginning of God's greatest use of my life. He chose the one experience in which I could not glory for his glory. For those of you who know the story of Chuck Colson, who went from one of the most powerful men in Washington to a jail cell, where God turned his life around and now he's got a ministry that's impacting people all over the world. It's incredible to see. But it took the crippling effect of that moment in prison to bring him to his knees to face God. And from there, he didn't go into obscurity. He came back and began to build his life again in ministry. Max Lucado says it this way. He says, the reassuring lesson is clear. God uses and uses people to change the world. People, not saints or superhumans or geniuses, but people, crooks, creeps, lovers and liars. He uses them all. And what they may lack in perfection, God makes up for in love. Jesus later summarized God's stubborn love with a parable. He told about a teenager who decided that life at the farm was too slow for his tastes. So with pockets full of inheritance money, he set out to find the big time. What he found instead were hangovers, fair-weathered friends, and long unemployment lines. We could have told him that, couldn't we? Because we've all been there, prodigals in our own right. When he had just about as much of the pig's life as he could take, he swallowed his pride, dug his hands deep into his empty pockets, and began the long walk home, all the while rehearsing a speech that he'd planned to give to his father. He never used it. Just when he got to the top of the hill, his father, who'd been waiting at the gate, saw him. The boy's words of apology were quickly muffled by the father's words of forgiveness. And the boy's weary body fell into his father's open arms. The same open arms welcomed him that had welcomed Abram. Remember Abram? Abram the liar. And Moses. Remember Moses? The defining moment of his life was, there could have been two of them. We all remember the one. That was the burning bush, right? Wasn't that the defining moment of his life when God spoke to him at the burning bush and turned him? That could have been, but there was another one that could have been too. That was at age 40 years old when he murdered a guy. Remember that? Moses the murderer? Now wait a minute, Moses wrote the law. He's the one who received the Ten Commandments, which one of those Ten Commandments is, thou shalt not kill. Do you think there was a tear in his eye when he wrote that? Knowing that he had broken the law that he was recording. I believe the defining moment of Moses' life took place at the burning bush because he allowed himself to move past the other defining moment. Moses the murderer, David. We know about him, don't we? The man after God's own heart who wrote the Psalms. David the beautiful, who also committed murder along with adultery. And Jonah. We remember his bad days because they're kind of glorious. You know, a boat ride and a fish. What was he doing in that fish? You see, the code of ethics for a prophet is to preach what God says, to whom God says, when God says, and where God said. And God said, go preach at Nineveh. And what did Jonah do? He said, no possible way. I will not preach to those people. I will not do it now. I will not preach that message. And guess where I'm going? I'm going to the other side of the world. And he got on a boat literally to head to the other side of the world. Many scholars believe that the place he was headed is Spain, pretty far away from Nineveh. God said, no. See how well you can swim. Till the fish picked him up and took him back, and he preached the message, and a great revival took place. Now, these are the kind of men that God works with. No wagging fingers, Lucado says, no clenched fists, no I told you so slaps, or where have you been? Interrogations. No crossed arms, no black eyes or fat lips, no. Only sweet open arms. If you ever wonder how God can use you to make a difference in your world, just look at those He has already used and take heart. Look at the forgiveness found in those open arms and take courage. And by the way, never were those arms opened so wide as they were on a Roman cross. One arm extending back into history, the other arm reaching forward into the future. All embrace of forgiveness offered for anyone who will come. A hen gathering her chicks, a father receiving his own, a redeemer redeeming the world, drawing mankind to himself. If you've blown it, and you have, and so have I, Bible says, repent. Which means to turn around and go the other way. It means to confess, God, you're right, I'm wrong. I have blown it. I've quit trying to cover it up. And I change my life. Head in the other direction. And over a period of time, God begins to work in that heart. Begins to confirm His healing process. And over a period of time, God begins to change us from the inside out. And every wrong, every sin can be forgiven, and every person can be restored. That's the message of the gospel of grace. If you've given up, say, boy, you know, the defining moment of my life was when I committed this sin, and I'll never, ever move past it. You missed the whole point of the gospel of grace. Because God says He can heal and forgive, and change your life and move you forward. Abram. And he blew it big here. I don't know about you, but I kind of feel like that was recorded in the Bible for a reason. Maybe the reason is you this morning. Maybe the reason is you. Let's bow our heads. Father in heaven, we know how hard it is to accept this message because we're all sick, sick to death of those confessions that come as a result of being caught, those confessions that come as a result of lives being shaken up that don't represent the genuine, real thing. And yet we know, Father, that there are many people who really truly have repented and are at a standstill because they just can't come to grips with the fact that you would want to use them again. Father, for those people, I pray this morning, I pray that you would break through in a special way. I pray that you would cause them to see your loving power in their lives. And even like Abram, who resorted to trick plays, who used deception, Father, you can still work a miracle. Change that person's life around. Father, I pray for those who are still in their sin today, still in rebellion, and still lying. Father, I pray this message would not let them off the hook in any way, but they would be moved to true repentance. Father, for those who are needing to feel your touch of forgiveness, I pray that you'd give it to them today, power and love. Give them hope for the future. Father, we pray that you would change our feet of clay. Give us firm feet that are firmly attached to the rock of grace in Jesus Christ so that we may live in the power that you've intended us to overcome and live by faith. For we pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen.